I was thinking about what level to give these lectures, and my goal is that a large number of you can take something away from these lectures, that it's actually going to be useful. And in order to achieve that, I'm trying to start at an elementary level. So I apologize for those who already know these things or know about many of these things. And but I hope that in this way, many of you can profit from the lectures. And, well, if there's something you don't understand, please feel free to interrupt and ask questions. So what I would like to tell you about is how to compute loop integrals, which are typically of the following form, where you have some integrals, space-time integrals, say in d dimensions, or actually multiple integrals like this, and where you integrate some integrand, which is typically of a form that could come out of a Feynman diagram calculation, so where the integrand could be some propagators downstairs, some product of propagators, and upstairs you have some numerator, which could come from the evaluation of spinner traces, for example, if you have diagrams of fermions. So that's typically what occurs in many calculations. Where does this show up? So, for example, that shows up if you want to compute scattering amplitudes. So if you want to compute scattering amplitudes at loop level, and there's some other lectures which at the school which deal with scattering amplitudes by Jake and Freddie, for example. And so these other lectures are about is tree level amplitudes, but I think in part also about this object here, what the integrand of scattering amplitude is that we're going to that we want to compute. And so what I'm going to tell you about is how to carry out these integrals, how to get from this form to some either analytic answer or to get some numbers out or to do other useful things with that. Well, these integrals are not limited to scattering amplitudes. You also need them if you compute, for example, correlation functions of local operators. So that's interesting, for example, because you could compute using these correlation functions, you can get anomalous dimensions. You can compute the scaling dimensions of these operators. So that's also somewhere where you need to know how to compute such objects. Actually, if you want to know more about this, there in the previous edition of the school from 2 years ago, Christoph Sieg, who's in the audience here, he gave a lecture about specific techniques for this problem. So if you have further questions on this, you can also ask Christoph Sieg, because I'm going to focus more on what's useful for scattering amplitudes. But it's not limited to that. All right. So now, one thing one has to know is that such loop integrals, they're in general not independent of each other. So there are many relations between integrals. So that's, of course, useful to know, because when we have a set of integrals that we may want to compute, it's useful to know a priori that some of them are actually interrelated and that we have to compute few of them. We don't have to compute all of them independently. And such relations, they can be obtained by using so-called IBP, integration by parts relations. So integration by parts, which basically follow from the fact that total derivatives in the integrand vanish, and this can give you some identities between integrals. So here I don't want to go into these integration by parts relations. I just want to mention that they exist and they're useful. But the upshot is that after modding out by these relations between integrals, what one has is that at the end of the day one arrives at a set of, we could call them master integrals, that one wants to evaluate. So there's a set of integrals that we need to evaluate, need to be computed. So how to compute these integrals? What methods can we apply to them? So there are a number of methods which are very useful, and so for example, let me just list some of them. One method actually uses differential equations. So how does this work? Maybe if you have some scattering amplitude, let's say some diagram that you have some four-particle scattering amplitude like this, and imagine it depends on the Mandelstam variables S and T, where if you have some scattering P1 through P4 and say, of massless particles, say S is the usual Mandelstam invariant P1 plus P2 squared, and T would be the other invariant P2 plus P3 squared, then you could think about computing derivatives of this function of some, say this could be some four-point integral. You compute the derivatives of this integral and then integrate back. And there's a well-developed method due to Kotikoff, German, and Remedy, which uses these differential equations. So that's very very useful. Then there are further specific techniques which are especially useful in the context of these correlation functions. And as I said, Christoph Sieg lectured about this 2 years ago. So there are some techniques. One is goes under the name of Gegenbauer. I guess it's called Gegenbauer X-phase technique. Then there are further tricks which use conformal symmetry. Which are very useful to compute specific integrals. So I'm not going to talk about these techniques today. And what I would like to focus on is another method which goes under the name of Mellin-Barnes. So I'll explain what that is. And, I'll explain in a minute what this is, actually, in this lecture today. So let me just say what the features of this technique is. So one advantage of this Mellin-Barnes technique is that it's very universal. So in other words, it doesn't really matter much what the specific form of your loop integral is. For example, you can apply it sort of in one go for integrals which have arbitrary powers of the propagators. So it's very convenient. You do one calculation, or you think about your problem once, and then you can solve for a large class of things. So that's very convenient. Typically, it's also something useful if you want to do a numerical evaluation. So typically, it's something which rather easily allows you to get numbers out of your integrals, which is not completely obvious in the initial form. So that may also be useful. There's also some nice features that if you're interested in some asymptotic limits, if we consider this four-particle problem, if you're interested in what happens to my integral if, say, S is much bigger than T, which would correspond to the Reggie limit, these Mellin-Barnes representations are very... from these Mellin-Barnes representations, it's easy to extract such limits analytically. Another advantage, this also relates to the topic of the school, is that this technique is very easy to automate. So it's easy to program things on the computer, and in fact there already exist some very useful packages in Mathematica. So for example, you can use Mathematica, I will describe them either today or in tomorrow's lecture. So there's one package which you can download, which is called mb.m, and I'm also going to describe some functions of mb asymptotics. .m, I guess, which can be used to evaluate analytically such asymptotic limits. Of course, there are also negative features to this method. The very fact that it's such a universal method could also be viewed as a negative point, because if you have some very specific integral which maybe has symmetry properties or for some reason is very simple, well, this method is unlikely to show it to you. You may discover it at the very end of a calculation, but since it's so general, it doesn't really exploit all of the doesn't necessarily exploit all the simple features of a given problem. So maybe you don't see all the simplicity of specific integrals could be hidden. Can be hidden. So just to give an example, sometimes you can have integrals which satisfy very simple differential equations, which actually allow you to see some structure for given classes of integrals to all loop orders, but it's not so that such kind of properties would be hidden in such a Mellin-Barnes approach, or it would be more difficult to see such properties. All right. So what I'd like to do today, the plan is, I'd like to start with loop integrals like these. So we have some d-dimensional integrals of this form. Numerator over propagator. Now, what I'd like to tell you about is how to get from there to the Mellin-Barnes representations. And we'll do this using an intermediate step, which is to introduce Feynman parameters, which probably most of you know about, but I'll just quickly review that. And then I'll tell you how to go from a Feynman parameterization to a Mellin-Barnes representation. And once you've got the Mellin-Barnes representation, I'd like to show you what you can do with that. So what to do with it. And so that will entail things like, as I said, how to evaluate limits. If you're computing some integral in dimensional regularization of d equals 4 minus 2 epsilon, then it will be interesting to see how we can actually perform the epsilon expansion. So that's something that can also easily be automated. Tell you about how to get numbers. So all of this is analytical, but at some point it may be interesting to just, you know, go from this integral to some number for specific kinematical points. So I'll tell you how to do a numerical evaluation starting from a Mellin-Barnes representation. I guess there may be some other points depending on time. So this is the plan of the talk for today, and so we'll see either today or tomorrow, depending on how much time there is. I'll also tell you more about how you can implement these things in Mathematica. All right, so maybe this is a good point to see if you have any questions or comments on something you'd like to hear. Excuse me. Sorry, what is the difference between? Oh, a reference? So there's some original papers from the 90 or 91 by Kotikov. So say around the 90s. And then this, which basically, where this idea was explained basically for massive integrals, where the idea is if you have some propagator with a mass, p squared plus m squared, then you can take this derivative with respect to the mass and obtain equations and solve them. And then later around the 2000, then this was this method was used much more broadly and systematically by German and Remedy. So as far as I know, for example, they were first to compute in dimensionalization such four-point integrals like this, where you have three on-shell legs and one off-shell leg, which are some complicated diagrams which can be computed using this method. Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, this was sort of, didn't have much space yet, but I will... We'll try to do that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so so let me start by saying how you can get from the loop integral to some Feynman parametrization. So is there? How many people haven't seen Feynman? Well, this is a bad question, but how many people haven't seen Feynman parameters yet? Everybody's seen Feynman parameters? I guess that's... So I'll be very brief here. So to set the notations.
It doesn't really matter too much, but just for simplicity, I'm going to assume a situation where we have for a moment, no numerator, and we just have a product of propagators. So some scalar loop integral for a moment. Now, in that situation, so we have something which looks like this. We have some terms, trying to write bigger, a1 to some power, little a1, and a product of n terms like this. And so, as you know, what you do is that you can Feynman combine this using the following formula. So you have gamma of A. Downstairs you have product from 1 to n gamma of AI. And then you have an integral over Feynman parameters. I'm calling them beta. Upstairs you have a delta function of all the Feynman parameters and some product here over the Feynman parameters raised to the power a minus 1. And downstairs, you just have the sum of all the a's multiplied by the Feynman parameters to the power a. And this power a, which also appears here, is just the sum of the exponents of the indices.
Well, typically, what one does is one introduces this formula, which then allows one to have a very simple integrand here. And then by doing a shift in the d-dimensional integration variable, one can bring this into a form where one just has to evaluate something of the following type, where you have a d-dimensional integral. Let me normalize it conveniently. And... d-dimensional integral where one just has a term k squared plus something which you can call delta to this power a. So again, the linear term can be made to disappear by doing a shift in the integration variable. So we just need to know what this integral is, and I think probably all done this exercise by introducing radial coordinates, etc. So I'll just write down the answers. You get again some gamma function. D half over 2 minus A over gamma of A, and then you have delta to some power D over 2 minus A, I guess. Oops, this is wrong. It should be A minus D over 2. Okay. So so using these formulas, you can immediately do any one loop integral. In other words, you can transform any one loop integral to this Feynman parametrization. So let's actually do this for a generic one loop diagram. So if we have a generic one loop diagram, momenta p1, p2,
2 tetra going in. And let's just call this the loop momentum K. So then this is nothing else than the d-dimensional integral normalized in some convenient way. And here we have a product of obvious propagators. So first one would be K squared. And just to be very general, let us also allow a mass. So let's say it has mass M1 squared. And then the second propagator would be K plus P1 all squared, and let's allow a different mass, M2 squared, and so on and so forth. And the last propagator would be just K minus PN squared plus MN squared. And actually, just to make it more general, let us also use arbitrary powers here. So I didn't write this. So let's have this power A1. And raise this to the power a2 and this to the power an. So this would be a very general, most general scalar one loop integral. Okay, so now. Now we can, using these formulas, we can immediately write down the Feynman parameterization. One very convenient thing to do here is the following, is to do to write the answer in some different variables in so-called dual or region coordinates, where we replace the momenta by some other coordinates x, which we define in this way. So, and also we change the... do a change of variables in the loop integration variable. So we go from k to some integration variable x0. So how does this work? So for example, what this means is that p1 is equal to x1 minus x2. So if you look at our propagators, k squared would just be the difference between x0 and x1 squared. And then if we have, if you look at the second propagator, k plus p1 all squared, well, we can just add this up, and we get x0 minus x2 squared. So that's it. Sorry about that. So that's a... For the moment, that's a very convenient notation. So if we just take this this loop integral over here, in this new notation, it's just an integral over this new loop variable x0 over I pi to the d over 2. And then you can see that the propagators will now just can be written very conveniently in the following form, a product from j equals 1 to n of x0j squared plus mj squared. And remember, we allowed for arbitrary powers of the propagators. Okay, okay, so now we just rewrote the loop integral, but now applying these two formulas, you find that this is equal to the following. So we get a bunch of gamma functors, of course. So we have this gamma of... the gamma of A cancels, but we have gamma of A minus D over 2. Then downstairs we have a product of the gammas of the indices. And then we have the integral over the Feynman parameters. So here I'm just copying the numerator from over there. J to the aj minus 1. And now the nice thing is that what's written downstairs is extremely simple. So here you just have the sum over I smaller than j of xij squared beta I beta j plus the term of the masses. And the term of the masses is just the the sum over mj squared of j. And the whole thing is raised to a power a, of course.
Sorry, not a, what is it? A minus d of t.
Okay.
And alpha is beta, yes, thank you. I usually write alpha, but since I have A, I figured it's nicer to call it beta. All right, so actually this is a very important formula. It's useful to remember it, because with this formula you can you can forget about the, well, actually this is also part of the formula. With this formula you can forget about these intermediate steps, and for a given plane of one-loop integral, you can immediately write down the Feynman parameterization without having to think. Well, let's discuss some features of this Feynman representation. Well, it's already, in some sense, it can be more useful than the original loop integral, because in simple cases, it may already allow you to obtain a numerical value for the integral if you want to obtain that. It can also be often the starting point for an analytical evaluation of the integral. So you could imagine starting to actually carry out the Feynman parameter integrals and eventually arrive at an analytical formula for the integral. One other nice feature is that the dependence, if you're in dimensional regularization, the dependence on D or on epsilon, if you're in 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions, is already a little more explicit than it was in the original formula. Well, really what it is, it's really the definition of what this integral means in dimensional regularization. So you have the dependence already a little more explicit. However, in cases where you have actually poles in epsilon, where your integral is divergent, you still have to think about how these poles come out of this integral. So in those cases, not yet as straightforward as one would like. And another negative feature is that typically there are many parameters. Well, there are as many as we have propagators, minus one here. So that is most of the times that's a little inefficient. So it's not the one still has to do some work to actually get something useful most of the time. All right. Let's see if I'm doing the time. So I have one example, but I'm going to skip it, I think, just to get to the Mellin Barnes representations. Didn't hear that. Could you repeat the question? How many legs? So this, in this example, we have an arbitrary number of external legs. Could you repeat the question? Oh, you mean in practice when this would cease to be efficient? Well, honestly, I don't know. Typically, I don't know. I don't think it would be efficient if you have many external legs, but I can't give you a precise number. How do you deal with terms in the numerator? Sorry, can you repeat it?
How have you obtained the term with the sum by I and J?
Oh, how do you get this?
Yes.
Well, as I said, this is you can get to this formula by applying these two relations. There was one step I didn't do explicitly. But I mentioned it when from this form. In general, you have also linear terms in K. So you have something like K dotted into a vector B. And then what you do, you want to get rid of this linear term
And you can do it by shifting the loop integration variable. So you shift it, and then you get to this form where you just have k squared. And well, in doing so, if you go through the details, you will find this this other form I wrote. So I didn't give all the details of that derivation, but it's the only thing you need are these three steps, the two formulas and the shift and the loop integration variable.
All right.
So I have one example here, but I think given time, I'll save it for tomorrow probably. So so let me immediately go to the Mellin-Barnes representation. So, what's the idea? So, I told you that it's very inefficient that we have so many Feynman parameters. So, really what we would like to do is we want to carry out the Feynman parameter integrals. And so there's a formula that we would like to use, which is basically the formula for which defines the beta function. So, if you have integrals like this over Feynman parameters, so with this delta function here, from 1 to n, beta j minus 1. And in general, we have a product, beta j over, let's call it aj minus 1. So this formula here, without the denominator, if everything is factorized in the Feynman parameters, this can be easily carried out. It's actually just an expression given in terms of gamma functions. So it's a product of the gammas of the AJs divided by the gamma function of their sum, which I previously called A. So that's a formula we would like to use to carry out the Feynman parameter integrals. But in order to do so, obviously we can't use it in this form, but we could if we were able to factorize the denominator here. So this is the idea to go to this other representation. We want to use something which factorizes the denominator here. So factorize integrand. And so the idea is to use the following trick. It's that if you have 1 over a plus b to some power lambda, you can write this using some contour integral, which is this Mellin integral. So you can write this as some contour integral which goes from minus I infinity to plus I infinity, plus some specific real part which we're going to determine. It's almost like this. And what you integrate over is gamma of minus z, the complex integration variable, gamma lambda plus z over gamma of lambda, a to the z, b to the minus lambda minus z. So let me explain this formula. First of all, what do we integrate over? So if we draw this in the complex z plane, let's first think about the poles of those gamma functions. So gamma of minus z has a pole at z equals 0, and then at all integer values of z. So these are the poles of gamma of minus z. So typically we imagine that lambda will be some positive number. So in that case, the poles of gamma of lambda plus z will be somewhere here. The first pole being at z equals minus lambda, then the next one at minus lambda minus 1, etc. We have these two sets of poles which we're interested in. And now, in this definition, I didn't tell you yet what z0 was, the real part where we integrated from. So z0 is by definition is somewhere in between these two, in between the poles of this gamma lambda plus z and gamma of minus z. So we have z0 somewhere in between here. So we want that minus lambda is smaller than z0 is smaller than 0. And then given this,
this integration is just going from minus I infinity to plus I infinity here. So that is how the integral is defined. Now let's convince ourselves that it makes sense. Well, so how should you think about this formula? Well, this formula is actually very similar to what you would obtain from doing a series expansion of this object here. And how could you do a series expansion? So let's compare this. So, well, you could imagine that either A is bigger than B or the other way around. For example, you could have just assume one of the cases. Let's say that A over B is very small. In this case, we can expand in the following way. We have this object here, and we can now expand the bracket. So we'd have we can actually give it in closed form. We'd have a sum. So this is just some alternating sum, n equals 0 to infinity. Minus a over b to the n, and you have some gamma functions, gamma of n plus lambda, gamma of lambda, gamma n plus 1. Now, what I'm trying to tell you is that this Mellin-Barnes representation actually is very similar to the series expansion. Now, let's see how this comes out. Well, if we again... Now, let's go back to the Mellin-Barnes representation and assume A over B much smaller than 1. Well, what we have then, this term we could also write as B to the minus lambda and then A over B to the Z. So this is a small number. In order to sensibly expand this, we want Z to be positive, the real part of Z to be positive. Now, at the moment, the integration contour is, by this definition, is for negative real part of Z. So that isn't that wouldn't give a sensible expansion. So what we want to do is we want to deform the integration contour to positive values of Z. In other words, it makes sense to close the contour on the right here, because then we'll be in this region where the series expansion converges. Likewise, if we had chosen B to be smaller than A, then we'd prefer to close the integration contour on the left. And we'd get another expansion, which would be, again, the expansion where we had B much bigger than, sorry, B much smaller than A. So in fact, what this Mellin-Barnes representation gives you, it's a little more general than this expansion because it knows about both expansions. It knows about the A much smaller than B expansion and about the A much bigger than B expansion. But now let's just see how the first one comes out. So in this case, we'd close the integration contour on the right. Because then as I said, this is the region where this expansion is valid, and specifically the contribution from infinity will drop out. So then what we get is just the sum of all the residues, infinite series of residues from these poles. So we'll just have that. Just have the following. So we just have at this Mellin-Barnes integral. So since the contribution from infinity vanishes, we can for free turn it into a contour, into a closed contour integral. And that then evaluates just the sum from 0 to infinity of all the residues from those poles. So residue from gamma minus z, gamma lambda plus z, gamma lambda, a over b to the z, b to the minus lambda, and we take this residue at z equals n for any n integer and n equals 0. Okay, and then, so then to see that these two are equal, so you just have to compute this residue, and so that's by, that's easily done. So where does the poles, of course, they come from this gamma of minus z, as we discussed, so we just need to figure out how gamma of minus z behaves near z equals some integer value. So that's easy to do, so you can compute that, for example, gamma of minus n plus epsilon at the leading order, and epsilon just behaves as minus 1 to the n over epsilon. So that's the pole we get the residue from, gamma of n plus 1. And so if you plug this in, you see that you get exactly this formula over here. Okay. So how do we use this now? Well, obviously now so this works if we have a denominator which just consists of two terms. Now, but what do we do if we have a denominator of more terms? Well, we just need to use this formula iteratively. And so actually, let me just give you a small exercise here. So if you have something which consists of three terms, for example, then you have the following. You have the following formula. You now have something where you have two Mellin-Barnes integrations because you needed to use the basic formula two times. And the integrand now is gamma of minus z1, gamma of minus z2, gamma lambda plus z1 plus z2 over gamma of lambda. And a to the z1, b to the z2, c to the minus lambda, minus z1, minus z2. So so here you are. That's a useful exercise to derive this formula from that one over here. And similarly, you can derive a very simple formula if you have an arbitrary number of summons here, which then obviously is very useful to what we want to do. So then from this analysis, it's clear that we can take any integral which is in the Feynman parameterization, and depending on how many terms we have in the denominator, we can always find a Mellin-Barnes representation of the same integral. Yes, very good. So, indeed, part of the exercise is also think about what are the allowed real parts for the two contours, indeed. All right. So, well, basically I'm running out of time for today, but then I'm not. Oh, so how much time do I have, actually? Confused. That's good. That's good. But okay, just let me just. I thought I had it until 10:15. But maybe I got confused. So until 10:45 then. Excellent. Okay. Oh, well, okay. Well, you didn't interrupt me, so I suppose I'm not going too fast, or am I? I don't know. I skipped some examples, so, but maybe also we can look more at examples during the exercises then. Okay, great. So then, we can relax a little bit. So, now
What I told you so far should enable you to start from a loop integral, go to Feynman parameters, and then go to a Mellin-Barnes representation. So now we have a Mellin-Barnes representation for our favorite integrals. Now, what do we want to do next? What can we do with these Mellin-Barnes representations? So what can we do? Well, there are a couple of things you may want to do. I told you initially that it's often simple to get a numerical, to do a numerical evaluation of integrals. So that's something we'll look at. We've already seen that in at least in the derivation of this Mellin-Barnes representation, can be useful to think about closing the contour or contours in general on one side and get some series expansion of the answer. So that'll in general give you some series expansion. And as we saw over there, the simple expansion of 1 over a plus b. And in general, you can also get asymptotic expansions in this way. So that happens, for example, when your functions are not simple algebraic functions, but say logarithms or polylogarithms or things like that. Then you could get them. You could do some asymptotic expansion in a regime where some parameters are big or small. So this was this example we mentioned earlier, for example, the Reggie limit. And another very useful thing to understand is, as I said initially, in dimensional regularization, if you have divergent integrals defined in d equals 4 minus 2 epsilon or integer minus 2 epsilon dimensions, we actually want to resolve and carry out this epsilon expansion. So we want to know what the poles of the integrals are and what the coefficient of these poles are, and compute the finite coefficients of the poles and also the finite parts. Okay, so let's just start with the point one.
Since you are fine, can you put together what's the final expression for some momentum interval?
Yes. In fact, now actually, I figure it might be useful to do my example because that's the example I wanted to do. You want to see some final result for an example?
Yes.
Oh, good. Great. So I guess I can erase this. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's good to have some example in mind indeed, because this is, since I'm talking about endpoint integrals so far, it's maybe very abstract, but let's do something very concrete. A question, yes. When I wrote k squared in the propagator, yes.
When you write k squared in the propagator, do you mean a Euclidean signature or Minkowski signature?
Ah, okay, that's a very good point. Well, it didn't matter very much for the formulas, but in the formulas I wrote were valid in Minkowski signature. So you notice I have divided by some I pi, some power. So that's in Minkowskian signature.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, so actually let's look at some example. So let's look at a simple triangle integral at one loop. So we have the following integral. We have some momentum p1, p2, and some off-shell momentum going in here. So this would be p1 plus p2. So let's say they're all ingoing. And, oops, this doesn't make sense, of course. So these propagators here in the middle, just for the sake of the exercise, let's say they have supposed to have mass m. So, for example, this would be 1 over k squared plus m squared. and they're all supposed to have powers 1. So this is something, some integral you may want to evaluate, or you could encounter, for example, if you imagine this is some process where you could create a Higgs with some gluon fusion, which with a top running in the loop. So this M would then be the top mass. But anyway, for us, it's just some example. So what's the definition of this integral? It's actually a finite integral, so we can compute it in 4 dimensions. Let me just put d equals 4. So k squared plus m squared, k plus p1 all squared plus m squared, which is this propagator, and finally k minus p2 squared plus m squared. Okay. And you can write this in the x variables as I indicated, but we don't want to do this now. Let's just discuss quickly the kinematics. So I said we want to have p1 and p2 massless on shell. So we have P1 squared equals P2 squared equals 0. And so this actually leaves only one Lorentz invariant here, apart from a mass, namely S, which is equal to P1 plus P2 squared. And the other Lorentz invariant would be just M squared. So in other words, our problem depends on these two variables. Now, in terms of the formulas we had previously, we have A. All the powers of the propagators, they are equal to 1 for j equals 1 to 3. And this variable A, which was the sum of the aj's, is then just equal to 3. So now we can just plug in into what we had previously, and so the Feynman representation is just then the integral from 0 to 1 over the betas. In this case, we have 3 betas because we have 3 propagators. So we have the delta function upstairs. There are no additional factors here because all the indices are equal to 1. So you can see this really simplifies a lot. And now remember here we had the sum of the xij squared. So now we just have to think what xij squareds we have. And in fact, these on-shell conditions they imply that some of the xij squared are 0. So in particular, p1, this is nothing else than x12 squared actually. So x12 squared is 0, and similarly, x23 squared is also 0. So this is 0, and finally, if you look at what p1 plus p2 squared is in this x notation. This is nothing else than x13 squared. So in the sum here, 2 of the 3 terms are actually 0, and we just have 1 term left. So it's the x13 squared term left. So it comes with a beta 1, beta 3 times s. And then we have a mass term. Here all the masses are equal. So we just get beta 1 plus beta 2 plus beta 3. Times the mass squared. And the whole thing, it was to the power a minus d over 2. So a is 3 and d over 2 is 2, so we have power 1 here. And in fact, there's a further simplification here because you see the sum of the betas, it also appears in this delta function. So here we can just replace this by 1. S, the Mandelstam invariant S, which is equivalent to x13 squared. Right.
The integration over beta goes from 0 to 1 or 0 to infinity?
Yeah, so if you like, it's always from 0 to infinity, but since we always have this delta function, which makes it a projective integral, it doesn't really matter. So it's either way. Yeah.
Okay. So now now it's easy to go from this to the Malin Bonds representation, because we can see what we just have two terms in the denominator. So this is really the simplest case we just discussed previously. So so again, we have this guy. Maybe let's just multiply it by S for convenience to make it a dimensionless function. So we have, again, S log of betas. Beta 1, beta 3, S plus M squared. So now, so you see it just really just depends on an M squared over S, with the only dimensionless variable in this problem. And so now what we do, we apply once the Malin-Bonds formula. Then we interchange the Malin-Bonds and the beta integrations, and we carry out the integral over the betas using this simple formula which was written over there. And so which just evaluates into gamma functions. And so I'll give you the formula that one gets. We have a single Malin-Bonds integral. So we have the gamma of minus z, and then we have a gamma cubed of 1 plus z, and the whole thing is divided by gamma of 3 plus 2z, times, now this dimensionless variable, m squared over s, so the minus 1 minus z. So you see that you get some very simple Malin-Bonds formula, and here for the integration, as we discussed before, the real part is contained between 0 and, in this case, minus 1. Because remember, in general, this was minus lambda, and the power of this denominator here was 1. So that's how this comes about. Yeah, this is basically the product of, it comes from two origins. The first origin is when you introduce, when you factorize this denominator using the Malin-Bonds formula. And then there are more gamma functions which come when you carry out the integral over the Feynman parameters. And this is the result. Okay, very good. So now actually we can use this immediately to see how we could numerically evaluate this. Now what we'll assume is, we'll assume that the this ratio m squared over s is positive. I'll tell you later why we want to assume this. We should think about this integration here. So remember, this was an integration in the complex plane from minus I infinity to plus I infinity. And so we can think about whether this how this integrant behaves as we go into the complex plane. And now the point is that if you have a gamma function of some complex argument a plus ib, where a and b are just some real numbers, for b very big, this actually falls off exponentially. So I don't remember the, I think it's something like, I think there's some numerical factor like pi squared over 2, and there are also subleading corrections, power-like corrections. But the main point is that this drops off very, very rapidly here. So in other words, this is typically it's an integral which converges very rapidly. So in fact, in practice, you don't always need to integrate from minus I infinity to plus I infinity. Very often, it's sufficient just to integrate from minus 4i to plus 4i or something like that, because it falls off so quickly. Now the other common is also, of course, sometimes it could happen that this exponential behavior gets
gets modified if you have some argument here. So we have another exponential here, for example. If this is negative, then potentially something bad can happen here, and you have to worry about the numerical convergence of your expression. So I don't want to do that here, so that's why I'm assuming that this variable is positive. But if you assume this, then you can just integrate this. So for example, you can just parameterize Z by some real and some imaginary parts. So this would be this Z0 we had previously. So then you just do the change of variables. It gives you an I, and you just integrate over Y from principle from minus infinity to plus infinity. So our integral, let's call this I. So I would then just be integral from minus infinity to plus infinity over I dy, 2 pi I. And this, if you call this this was the integrand as a function of z, then we have this integrand evaluated at z0 plus iy. And we said we were allowed to choose any z0 between 0 and minus 1. So you can choose your favorite. For example, let's just choose z0 equals minus 1/2, if you like. All right. So now, if we choose some specific numerical value for the only variable m squared over s, then we can just get a number out of this. For example, by using, if you like, you can use just n integrate of Mathematica, or alternatively, if you go to, which works well in this simple example. Alternatively, if you go to mb.m, I have some function which I'll explain in more detail tomorrow, which is called mb integrate, which you can use to carry out this integral.
A particular example to compute simply from the first line.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, actually, in a second, just for reference, let me also give you the result analytically, just to, if you want to do some numerical tests with this. Before that, let me just write down this comment I made earlier, that given that these gamma functions drop off so quickly in the complex plane, you could also approximate this. And for example, it's in practice, it's often sufficient to integrate, for example, from minus 5 to 5, because all these the other contributions are suppressed exponentially. So you see, this is something you can just test and see how well this approximates this exact formula here. So just to answer Pedro's question, for reference, I'll give you also the analytical result, which you could get from just carrying out these two remaining integrations here. So let me denote x. The only variable which we have is x is m squared over s. And let me also introduce some variable tau, which is... So then this integral over here, if it's a function of x, it's so the analytical result is 1/2 logarithm of this doesn't make sense. We have a lot of recursive definitions, but this is not one of them. So it's just 1/2 log squared of tau of x. If I got all the factors right, but I think it's great. As I said, you can just this of course you can evaluate for some numerical value of x, and I think it's interesting to see if you get the same numbers out of here.
Very good, very good. That brings me to my second point. Yes, so indeed, so the second point is what happens if you try to close the contour? Well, it will work just as the example when we did the, or almost like the example when we did the Taylor expansion previously. So let's think a little bit about that. So the second point, can we close the contour? And so this would give us some expansion of the result. Expansion in some small variable. So the only variable is x is equal to m squared over s. So typically, what could happen is that we want to evaluate this integral for large values of s. So there's a large energy compared to the mass. So let's just assume this case, and derive an expansion in this limit. Now, in our integrand, in our Mellin-Barnes integrand, x appears to the power minus 1 minus z. So if this is small, we want to close the contour where the real part of this exponent is positive. So in other words, we want to close it on the right again, just as we did previously. So the situation is really much like the one when we introduced the Mellin-Barnes parameter initially. So we still have this gamma of minus z, which has poles here. So these are the poles of gamma of minus z. And then you have this gamma of 1 plus z cubed. Oops, should leave some space for our contour. You have the gamma of 1 plus z cubed, which has poles here. And so if we close the contour to the right, we get a valid expansion in this regime. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. You're allowed to correct me if I'm saying nonsense. So let's see again. We want this to be small. So I said we want the exponent of this to be positive. So I'm sorry. So we have to close the contour on the left. Right. So because if z is smaller than minus 1, then this exponent becomes positive, etc. So actually, we want to pick up these poles here. And so now what you could do is write a formula as we did previously, where you just say this integral is equal to the infinite sum, where you sum up all the residues of those poles, which is a valid formula. So you can write I of x is equal to, so I think here we need to be careful because there might be a sign. No, let me not be careful about the sign. So we could write this as an infinite series of, well, we pick up all of the residues from minus 1 to minus infinity of these integers of the residues of the integrand. We call the integrand g. They're evaluated at these values. Okay, let's just think about the sign. So how does this work? So we have our integration. We have the poles. So the integration goes like this. And we close like this. So I guess it's... I guess the sign depends on whether you're a mathematician or not. I guess we should. What's the convention? I think this is a plus sign, right? If, Okay, so then maybe I forgot a sign previously when we discussed closing the font zone, right? So maybe we want to check that. Okay, so like this, we obtain this formula. Now the problem is like this: we get an infinite series, and well, in some cases, in this simple example, we could probably even compute all the terms in this series and figure out how to resum them. So that's something that we want to do. So you could resum series. I haven't tried here, but it's probably not too difficult. But one other interesting thing one could do is try to obtain an approximation. Obtain approximate formula for a situation where x is much smaller than 1. And now the key observation is that in fact there are terms in this formula which are subleading with respect to others. Because you see, if we compare the situation where we integrate here, the real part of z is between 0 and minus 1. So we still have some negative exponent of x here. But if we manage to shift the contour around this pole here, we pick up some contribution, which is a term in this, which is actually the first term in this series here. But then the new integral we have is actually for real part of z between minus 1 and minus 2. So now we're already in a situation where the exponent of this x is positive. So in that situation, we would expect that this integral is much better behaved if x is small. And in fact, we expect that it should vanish as we take x to 0. So in other words, the leading term in this expansion will come from the first term here, and then the consecutive terms will give power corrections to this formula, or at least, in any case, subleading corrections. So we could write approximatively I of x is just the residue at t of z. Z equals to minus 1, plus some corrections. In this case, it would be things which vanish as x goes to 0. And now, if we do this, maybe another nice exercise, what you should get is just 1/2 of log squared of x, which is, you see, in this limit here, you should, this tau variable, it should just go to x if everything is correct. So this would be the first term here, so we'd get some logarithm, and then the remaining terms should be power corrections. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think this is a good moment, actually. So the, yeah. So this was the second point in my list. Now for tomorrow, I'll finish the third point, which is to explain how you can resolve the epsilon expansion if you're in dimensional regularization, and obtain the pole structure of a diagram and then the coefficients of these poles, and then also what we'll discuss more. So this was very theoretical, so to speak, but this is an applied Mathematica school. So I'll tell you more about how we can actually implement these things in Mathematica, and do basically all of this, what we discussed on Blackboard today, automatically in Mathematica, either using existing packages or implementing something by ourselves. And so now for today, I think there's also an exercise session, right? So there are some exercises. Typically, they're also like organized like the lectures, so it's half-half. So the first part is to play around a little bit with the introduction of Feynman and Mellin-Barnes parameters, and then to think about what happens when you take various limits. And then, again, the second part will be to actually plug these in into Mathematica. But maybe even before tomorrow's lecture, there are some things you could already try without using these packages. For example, some things we discussed here, it might be just beneficial to just type them in and see how it works for you. Okay, so I'll stop here, and let's continue tomorrow.
Yeah, sure. Thanks.